Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts for today, and I'm here together with Kay Patak.
Hello, Ursula, and thank you, listener, for listening. We've got a lot of stories this hour on Local Talk. Let's start out with the weather for the week of February the 20th. I drove past the stomping grounds this weekend, and the outside dining terrace was full. That's a first for February. As always, Elwin Taylor's report is brought to you by the KHOI correspondent, Vaughn Kettleson.
Community Radio, KHOI. Vaughn Kettleson visiting with ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwin Taylor. And Elwin, it felt like summer in February here this past weekend. Will this continue on through the rest of the month?
Well, it's going to continue on the warm side of usual, but not like we had during a lot of last week. I don't think the 70s are, you know, they're not common in this month, and I don't think they're to be expected for the rest. We did have a good strong flow of air from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up into Canada, sort of on the west edge of Iowa and into the higher plains of Kansas, Nebraska, and the Dakotas. But that, of course, passes on its way, and we go into conditions that are more what we would be expecting for the winter. And so I don't think we can complain about having things that we would expect for the winter. The National Weather Service picture right now is not a bad one for the week, although we do anticipate, of course, the beginning of the week, scattered rain event, and one at the end of the week, if you will, that will also be going on. And then, of course, that's the next front that comes in from Canada way. And with the front coming in, of course, we do anticipate that we will have changes of direction of wind and more precipitation and so much for the very warm days. We do anticipate that the warmth during the next few days, yes, still maybe reaching the 60s, then the 50s, and nighttime temperatures going down to the 30s. That's just the kind of thing that we do have to expect. Do anticipate that as we get a little bit further along through the weekend with lows perhaps getting down below 30 degrees, I don't think below 20, but into the low 20s is possible by Sunday morning. We do anticipate in the 6 to 10 day outlook from the National Weather Service that we will be having conditions that are near normal for this time of year. That would be getting near 40 in the day and near in the 20s at night. And that's not unpleasant for winter. It'll be further east you get, the more abnormally warm it will be. West will be cold out on the west coast and into the Rocky Mountains, about normal chance of precipitation. And that will be the outlook to take us all the way from the 25th of February to the 5th of March. Those conditions, at least the way they appear right now. Does this mean we will have a wet summer, a hot summer, a dry summer? Well, really all it seems to mean right now is we will have a little higher likelihood of the June rain coming in May. In other words, if this season is getting over early, maybe the moisture that usually comes in May and June will start a bit earlier coming into the Midwest. Not a forecast, just a possibility that happens when we have this type of event. Well, we hope that you enjoy the weather this week and next week, and even though not maybe as ideal as it was a week ago, still a lot better than we often have for the, what we might say, what is often the dead of winter, now being the promise of spring.
ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwin Taylor joining us. I'm Vaughn Kettleson on KHOI Community Radio.
Thank you, as always, Vaughn and Elwin, for that report. And this is Local Talk on KHOI, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with Kay Patak. Kay, this past week, you recorded an interview with something that everyone has in common. I know it's time to do taxes, but in this case, I'm actually referring to death. Ames has had meetings in a few locations that are known as death cafes.
Yes, Death Cafe is an international movement which has come to Ames, Iowa. Death Cafe is a not-for-profit movement in which about 10 to 15 people at a time will meet over refreshments, and sometimes they go to town with those refreshments, to share conversation about death. These are not bereavement groups, as you might think, but rather they're free-ranging, informal conversations about end-of-life issues. There have been death cafes at the Ames Public Library and at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, where I spoke with Jonah Powell and Sarah Carlson about this. Let's hear Jonah, first of all.
They started, actually, in Switzerland in about 2013, and it then came across the ocean to the United States, and we've been around since almost then here in the United States. And we were attracted to it because it's become pretty well known that talks about death universally is healthy, but we don't talk too much about death here in the United States. And so it's an opportunity to kind of ease people's fear and the notions that talking about death is a no-no. When we first walked into it, we weren't real sure how it was going to go. And actually, we have found it to be very easy, and people are willing. It is, and we seem to be becoming more comfortable on our own with talking about it. So while you might not talk about it with around the family table with the teenagers and your younger children, when you get together with some of us who are elders, we find that we are very comfortable talking about it. It's very open-ended. We talk about whatever we want to talk about. It's open-minded conversations about death and dying, with the view of helping people who are really becoming more and more aware of their finite lives. We're not there to lead people to any specific conclusion or course of action. We don't do grief or bereavement counseling. As a matter of fact, the whole group works best when people are able to discuss death without being in extreme distress. And if somebody comes to our group and they have recently suffered a death in their family and are suffering, we then are able to refer people to appropriate places for them to be. This is not the place for them to be at this time. We stay very positive. Our group meets with anywhere from 8 to 12 people. Of course, we're appealing to the group within our fellowship. We start out with a group that all meets together. We generally have a topic that we go around and talk about. One of my favorite evenings was when the facilitator said, "Have you ever touched a dead person?" And as we went around and everybody spoke of it, there was some laughter, there was some memory, there was some seriousness, but it was a simple question that got us all involved and in which every single person participated. Questions that we might have asked: do we ever talk about death with family or friends? Or is it sort of a verboten? Have we ever sat with a dying person? In other words, we just pick some rather non-threatening topics involving death and dying and start out with the one group. And then we break up into smaller groups around a card table. There can be anywhere from 4 to 6, depending on the size of the group, at the card table. And at that point, for about the next hour or so, we just have a discussion. My experience has been that when we sit down, the conversation just proceeds from whatever the original question was. And I have not ever been at a table where the discussion has gone dead. If it happens to do that, there are small cards turned upside down in the middle of the card table, and we can just draw off the top. This one said, "Have you had any personal experiences with death?" Mm-hmm. Another one says, "What is a good death?" Okay. Another one was, "Death with dignity. What does that mean to you? Have you thought about it at all? Have you run into people who had unresolved issues while they were dying? So it's a great broad right. And so sometimes if a particular group, a small group, runs out of things to talk about, two things are going on. One, we have a roving facilitator, whoever is the hostess or the facilitator for that particular night, who just sort of moves from table to table, making sure that we're engaged. He or she may stop and interject something, giving us a new idea, or may just quietly stay there for a minute and then move on. The conversation, though, in my experience, is that it moves on all by itself.
That was Jonah. Now let's hear from Sarah Carlson, also of the Unitarian Fellowship in Ames. So what kind of things, in your experience, do people talk about?
Oh, okay, they talk about all sorts of things. When I mentioned the question about what are some of your earliest experiences with death, and that always brings a lot of conversation. Another topic might be, how do you talk with your family about end-of-life issues? It can be a real hard thing to bring up. And sometimes talking with your children about what arrangements you want to have. Children don't want to hear that. Sometimes talking with parents about what are their intentions. Have they thought about this? What are their wishes toward the ends of their lives? Some people have had single friends who don't have other family support and have been asked to be an executor of an estate or help in making end-of-life decisions with that person in a living will. So talking about some of those kinds of experiences, mm-hmm. What type of death would be an ideal death? Mm-hmm. Who would you want to have around when you're in the dying process? What happens when there's unresolved issues when you're facing death with relationships, and what have been people's experience mm-hmm. with that? Do they remain unresolved? Have people found ways to resolve them? What does that feel like afterwards? Experiences with children, and how do you explain death to children?
Right.
And how do you help them to understand that?
Yeah, that one's actually very germane to me, because my first husband was killed by lightning, you know, when he was hiking, mm-hmm. when my son was 13 months old. And mm-hmm. he didn't know. I mean, he was very physically active and climbing around all over the place at that age, but he hardly talked at all at that point.
Uh-huh.
And he finally reached the point when he was like in preschool, at about, I suppose, about 4 years old or maybe a bit older, that other people had daddies and he didn't. And mm-hmm. where's my father? Where's my daddy? And I said, well, he's dead. But he didn't really know what dead meant. Mm-hmm. And I remember he was playing with a friend at my house. They were playing with trucks and pushing these little trucks around, crawling around on the floor. And the friend said, the fact that Daniel's father was dead came up. And Josh looked up and he said, how did he die? And I looked at Dad, and Dan just kept his head down and was just pushing his truck and not looking up at all. And I said, well, Dan, I'll talk about that when Dan wants to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, that's when I realized I needed to get a bit of help about mm-hmm. bringing this topic up.
Yeah. And I had a situation when I was teaching a religious education course, and we knew that one of the children's mother was very sick. And then during this time together, the little girl's mother died. And I realized that we needed to talk with the children in the class and try to figure out how to explain things to them
right.
when this little girl came back to our class.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't something that we had thought about a lot, but we wanted to be intentional and very careful
right.
about that
right.
because when people experience a death, they experience a differentness when somebody close to you dies. And that's another topic people talk about, is oftentimes we feel awkward
right, exactly.
about what do I say when mm. someone's experienced a death.
Yes, and sometimes people are so afraid of that awkwardness that they avoid the person.
Exactly.
Which is very hurtful.
And in a death cafe, it's helpful to hear what worked for you. What did you do when it felt? What did you learn from that experience when you avoided somebody? If you experienced a death of someone close to you, what helped when other people approached you, and what was hurtful or harmful to you?
Right.
And so it's a learning experience, but it's, again, not a lecture.
Now, can I ask you a personal question?
Perhaps.
Would you like to talk about your first experiences with death or something of that nature?
My first experiences with death were probably deaths of animals, pets, or animals like birds used to fly into our window. And we'd gather it up and we would put it in a box, and we had a little graveyard up in my mother's stone garden where we bury these things. And sometimes we would have great fun making a funeral and being somber and playing. And I don't know how we learned about funerals. And then I didn't really experience a lot of death until high school, when I lost classmates to accidents. And that was difficult. I don't think at that time that schools dealt with the death issue very well. And I know nowadays people bring in counselors, or they make sure there's resources available. And so it was just something that happened, and things carried on, and we didn't talk about it. But I do remember having thoughts about it, and where is this person now, all the things that surrounded these horrific deaths, because they were usually car accidents or somebody drunk driving, somebody being hit, and very unexpected kinds of deaths. And so those are some of my experiences. With my father, I had the chance to actually be with him at the time he was dying. And that affected me profoundly. So that's something that I like to talk about in a death cafe.
Affected you profoundly in a good way?
Yes. It's hard to explain and hard to put in words, but it seemed like a very magical moment. He and I had not been really close. As an adult, I hadn't been there as much with him. And I was the sibling that could make it there when he was in his last moments. And I found myself doing very soothing things for him. I went out and I found audio tapes that had old-time church music kinds of things that I wanted to play for him, because that had meaning to him. And I rubbed his feet. I never would have rubbed an adult's gnarly, dry feet before, but I did things like that, and things that I never pictured that I would do. And in his last moments, his minister was there, and he was breathing in a difficult way, like dying people do, and the minister was reading the Lord's Prayer, I think. And in the background on that tape, there was the music. I'm not sure what the title of the song is, but it was something that they often played at Billy Graham revival types of things, when people were coming up and accepting Jesus. And my father was very much not involved, but appreciated that kind of thing. And the words to the song are, "O Lamb of God, I come." And as that song was playing, the minister read the Lord's Prayer, which would have been very soothing for my father. And then that song ended, "O Lamb of God, I come, I come." And then he breathed his last breath. And to me, that was very profound. And anytime I reflect on it, it's still very profound. And what I learned is about being present when somebody's dying. I wasn't there to question him or ask him about anything, ask him about salvation, or but just to be present and find things that had meaning for him. It wasn't about me.
Right. Well, that is a very moving experience.
And yes, to have that experience and being able to do that for somebody.
Yeah.
Changed me.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. That's a lovely story. Yeah.
So reading some of the cases of hospice nurses and their experiences mm-hmm. with people and what happens at the very end of life is very, very fascinating.
If people that are listening want to start their own death cafe, maybe at their church or, I don't know, amongst a group of their friends, mm-hmm. what should they do about this?
There is a website called thedeathcafe.com, and that's what we did. We went to their website, and they have a booklet that tells you what you can do. And it has various things about working with the movement, what you need to do, how to host the Death Cafe, who can be a facilitator, and how you be a facilitator. Again, it's not a therapy session, so you don't need a therapist. You need somebody to give ground rules and kind of guide and create the venue, and then the Death Cafe happens. You have a beginning, and you have an end. And you have refreshments.
Yeah, that's the cafe part.
Yes, yes.
In the picture on the website, they've got beautiful china and so on, which would be...
And often cakes. And mm-hmm. our group we bring refreshments each time. Mm-hmm. And people don't particularly come there to eat or drink. We usually do our death cafe in the evening around 6:30 or so. And... So that's not been as central a thing, but for other death cafes, I understand that is a big part of it, is having some sort of refreshment there.
Yes.
And it's like stopping in at any kind of cafe where you might meet with friends or meet people or sitting down at a table and enjoying food together and then having this very casual kind of conversation.
Okay. So you think there's enough guidance there on the website for people to start?
I do.
Yes.
I do. I think talking about death is fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It is.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thanks for that report, Kay. That was very interesting. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host today, together with Kay Patak. And we wanted to bring you a brief update on the Dakota Access Pipeline story here in Iowa. We hear a lot about North Dakota, but the story continues here in Iowa as well. On Wednesday, the Ames Tribune reported that the Polk County District Court of Iowa had rejected a joint lawsuit by the Sierra Club and a group of Iowa landowners who objected to the pipeline going through their land. They had filed suit against the Iowa Utilities Board and Dakota Access Pipeline. The district court ruled that the Iowa Utilities Board had not violated law in designating Dakota Access Pipeline as a utility, thus making the land subject to seizure by eminent domain. Among the landowners filing the lawsuit were Dick and Judy Lamb. We've spoken to them in the past about this issue, and the Lambs live in Iowa City, but they own land in eastern Boone County. If you take Highway 30 west of Ames, you will know their property because there's a large semi-trailer there with the words "Stopped Eminent Domain Abuse" written on the sides of the trailer. We have Dick and Judy Lamb on the phone now. Welcome back to Local Talk, Dick and Judy.
Hi, Ursula. Good to talk to you again.
Hi. Dick, tell us what happened.
At the court hearing, the judge said he would rule as soon as he could, and about a month and a half later, we did get the ruling, and we lost. We were not surprised by this particularly, and we're not deterred by it either.
Why weren't you surprised?
Well, it's an uphill battle. We know that. But district court judges, we have come to understand, are particularly reluctant to override state agencies. It is, the expertise resides with those agencies, at least that's the theory, and so they're reluctant. Now,
so
we think we have a better chance at the Iowa Supreme Court
So the state agency is the Iowa Utilities Board in this case?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. correct.
So what happens now?
Well, we wait. We will appeal the decision. That has to be filed within 30 days of the written decision here by the judge. And then we'll get notice that either the case will be heard at the Iowa Supreme Court or the Iowa Supreme Court will remand that to the Iowa Court of Appeals. We don't know which will happen. I would speculate perhaps that because of the importance and size of this case, it might just be heard immediately by the Iowa Supreme Court.
So what is the time frame for all this?
Don't know.
Now, do you think that the court was influenced at all by the fact that there was an executive order regarding the pipeline in North Dakota to go ahead with the project, even though there had been, after there had been a hold put on President Obama to do an environmental impact statement?
Just don't know that either. You know, I'm sure judges don't work in a vacuum. They're aware of what happens, what the mood is. Supposedly they're above all that, but it certainly didn't help, of course, that the direction changed at the presidential level.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's hard for us to imagine what this actually means on the ground. Has the pipeline been laid through your land already?
Oh, it's been a long time ago. As soon as, you know, we asked to have a stay put on the construction, and as soon as the judge denied that stay, they were immediately there digging in our ground.
Uh-huh. This is Judy Lamb speaking.
Yes.
So they went ahead and put the pipeline through the land.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And now, on what basis are you actually yourselves objecting to the pipeline on your land? I understand the legal argument you're making that this is not a utility and therefore the state doesn't have the right to use eminent domain to take the land. But why, tell us why this actually is detrimental to your land, why you're objecting.
Well, there are just many reasons why we object. From the perspective of a landowner, it's just the thought that a private company can come in and simply for their own profit take our land away from us. And that's what happened here. Keep in mind, this outfit in Texas, incorporated under the loose laws of Delaware, has never done anything for Iowa, never paid any taxes here, owes us nothing, and yet they were able to succeed in getting the police power of the state to simply take people's land. And I think people understand we object to that. See our land ripped up by these big machineries, and it was a big path. About 150 feet wide where they cut down the crops and ripped up the soil. And it just that damage alone will be many years recovering. It was in many ways, I think, like a home violation. People report when their home is robbed to see this kind of damage inflicted on their own property, particularly in a case like ours. It's been in the family for years and years. My grandfather purchased that farm in the 1870s. So we have strong personal feelings, just to start the list with.
And what was the land being used for that was used, that now was dug up?
It was corn and soybeans.
Uh-huh. A working farm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So this was basically a crop field.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And now, what does it look like now?
It looks good. I mean, I will say that the workers probably did the best they could to restore it. Now, looks are deceiving. If you were just look at it, the cover crop that would be there isn't growing because it got to be too late in the season to replant. But it doesn't look bad, but it's a bit of a misconception to think that you can do that kind of damage and simply scoop up the topsoil, put it back, and everything is back to the way it was. That is far from the case.
Mm-hmm. But as I understand, nobody's using the pipeline yet because it's not completed in North Dakota. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So right now it's just basically an empty pipeline going through your land?
Right.
That's the size of it, and we hope to keep it that way.
So what happens if you win your lawsuit? Are they then required to take the pipeline out again, or what happens then?
That could very well be. You know, it's probably a little hard to speculate on what the court might order. But I think if we won, the most likely outcome is that they would indeed have to take it out of our land, root it around, and carrying that to what probably might happen is that anyone whose land not only was condemned, as ours was, but who sold under the duress of condemnation might in fact say that their particular easement was also ineligible for purchase by the pipeline company.
Yeah.
And they have a right to require it to be taken out. So in
right.
effect, it could stop the whole thing. That could be the end of the pipeline if we win.
Mm-hmm. Although the way the court is moving, I'm afraid that the oil will be flowing before it's taken to the Supreme Court.
Right. You used an interesting word, condemned. Explain that. Your land was condemned?
Right. Most of the landowners sold willing easements. Now, willing, if we could put in parentheses, or I mean in quotes, because it was under the threat of condemnation. But we elected to actually let them condemn it, which means we got a summon, much like a criminal would, that there would be a hearing, and the hearing board condemned it, and they took it from us. So it was condemning just like is done for the justified purpose of building a road or a water line or something like that.
So that's a term that's used as part of the eminent domain process?
Right.
Uh-huh. Yes. That eminent domain means you can condemn.
Uh-huh. But it's a hard word for you to hear, you know, with land that you're, I mean, it's just, makes it sound like
indeed
a house that's falling
and,
down.
Indeed it is. You know, and it's funny. I mean, when that process server comes to your door, you do almost feel like a condemned criminal.
Uh-huh. Wow. So do you get payment for the use of your land?
We get a one-time payment for the easement through our land.
And was the fact that you are suing and refusing to cooperate willingly, does that affect the level of the payment that you get?
Yes.
Well, this particular lawsuit isn't about the payment.
Right.
It's about questioning the right to do it at all. So we are separately suing them for the damage award they gave, which we consider to be way low for what they've done. But this particular lawsuit is about the broader constitutional issue.
Uh-huh. So there's a separate case going on regarding that.
Right.
Yeah.
How many people, this was basically a joint lawsuit, how many people actually, landowners in Iowa, were part of the suit?
I think it's about a dozen. There were some that dropped out over time. I think we started with about 15, and at this point, something in the nature of 10 to 12, plus the Sierra Club.
The Sierra Club. And everybody plans to continue with the appeal?
As far as we know, everybody has.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the update. And Judy, it sounded like you were under the impression that this might go ahead before this is resolved, that they might go ahead and actually start using the pipeline.
Well, they haven't scheduled of course, they haven't filed for the appeal yet. And from what they're saying from North Dakota is that this pipeline will be finished before 30 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's okay. My fear is that oil will be flowing.
Okay.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that it can't be stopped.
We can always turn it off again, I guess, but it's
yeah.
Well, we're speaking with Dick and Judy Lamb. They own land here in Boone County, and they're one of the folks that own land where the pipeline has been laid, and they've been suing the State of Iowa Utilities Board and Dakota Access Pipeline, objecting to this. And sounds like it's a process that may go on for you for quite a while. And I appreciate you giving us an update on what's happening here in Iowa. The pipeline doesn't just affect North Dakota. It goes through the entire Midwest, you know, and including going right through here through Ames. So thank you for giving us an update on what's happening. And we probably will be speaking with you again in the future about an ongoing
well,
story.
Well, we're always glad to. It's good to talk to you again, Ursula.
Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people's stories and events in Central Iowa. As you may know, Iowa's mental health care system has been ranked nationally as 49th or 50th in the nation for several successive years. The group known as a Mid-Iowa Organizing Strategy, or AMOS, made up of 32 Central Iowa churches and related nonprofits, has decided to advocate for mental health at the State House every Tuesday this legislative session. Here is Jan Brown from Our Lady's Immaculate Heart Catholic Church in Ankeny, talking about how her church got involved.
We've been supporting an increase in the mental health tax levy. It started back in October when we talked to over 200 people in our parish, and they overwhelmingly said one of the biggest concerns they have is access to mental health care. So this fall, we had a legislative accountability session with our legislators for the Ankeny community and shared with them our concerns. We had over 150 people show up in that room expressing that this was a real urgent need for us. There were four sponsors: AMOS, NAMI, the Ankeny Mental Health Ministry, which is a group from the Methodist Church, and the League of Women Voters. Now the issue is at the state legislature. Two bills have recently been drafted, House File 343 and House File 342. House File 342 is signed by a group of 11 or 12 Democrats. House File 343 is signed by a Republican, Bobby Craftsman, from Cedar County. Basically, it would allow us to increase the tax levy in the counties that need that for mental health and disability services. What happened was that the tax levy was frozen at a dollar amount that was spent back in 1996. So we're still trying to live on the same budget that was proposed 21 years ago.
Okay, so the state legislature decided that counties should have a frozen budget and set this cap. Now, people who are aware that mental health services are by and large delivered by counties are asking for an increase in that cap.
Right. The Board of Supervisors would have to decide in each county whether they needed to increase their tax levy or not. Some of the counties actually could decrease their tax levy because their population has gone down. In counties like Polk County, our population has gone up 130,000. So we're trying to serve 130,000 more people with the same dollars that we were appropriated in 1996. There are many advocates that have signed on to this group, to this legislation, and are supporting it. AMOS is just one of many. Our organization of AMOS has decided that we will try to have as many people there on Tuesdays as possible to talk to legislators. Now, Tuesday of this week, the state social workers are all going to be there. NAMI has a legislative day. The nurse practitioners have a legislative day. The police have signed on to this, and the highway patrol. There's a huge number of people who are in support of this issue. The one body that we're facing in opposition is the Farm Bureau. And last year, the Farm Bureau was able to kill a bill so that it didn't happen. This year, we're hoping we have enough people to get it done.
What makes this issue especially important for you?
I think almost everyone has someone in their family or a friend that's affected by mental illness. One out of five people have these problems. I just don't think that we can turn our back on these people that need help. If we don't get the funding we need this year in Des Moines, the crisis centers may be closed. And that would certainly be very harmful.
Thank you.
This is Local Talk on KHOI. Before the music break by Ralph Towner, that was Jan Brown of Ankeny speaking for Amos, a group which is organizing every Tuesday visits to the State House on behalf of the mental health tax levy. These lobby days will continue until the session ends or they achieve their goal. If you'd like to connect with this citizen lobbying effort, you can contact Amos through their website, amosiowa.org. And it is an organization that recruits organizations, not individuals, but maybe your church or your whatever, your organization would be interested.
And that's A-M-O-S, Iowa.
Yeah, one word, amosiowa.org. Yeah.
And in this last part of the show, Lauren Franson is here with a monthly update from the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Lauren, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good morning.
It's good to have you. We missed you last month. You usually come in once a month. And so we didn't have a chance to speak with you about just the review of what happened last year, since it's the beginning of, it was the beginning of the year last month.
Yeah.
Can you give us a brief recap of 2016 and from the perspective of business?
Sure.
In Ames?
Yeah, well, from the Chamber's perspective, 2016 was another busy and full year of events and programming going on, both for the Chamber, our affiliate organizations, and our entire community. A couple of things that I wanted to highlight that the Chamber's, I suppose, most proud of for 2016. First, right here on Main Street, the Farmers Market had its sixth year and was the biggest yet.
Lots of people every Saturday.
Yeah, and, you know, we love seeing that. We love that the market's grown and has been a popular event for the whole community. I think they had 118 vendors this year. That's full-time, part-time, and the ones that were just there occasionally. And average attendance for this year was 3,100 people each week on Main Street. So
that's
exciting to have an event that's popular and draws a large crowd to downtown.
Makes us a destination?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it'll probably grow this year.
You know, we're hoping. It seems like in initial planning it's on track to, you know, more people are interested in it, more vendors want to be there. So, we'll see. Main Street should be busy again this summer.
That's very, very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
And another event that was Chamber-related was in November, actually the 30th anniversary celebration of our Leadership Ames program. They had an event out at Prairie Moon Winery with alumni and current members of Leadership Ames classes, the class 1 through class 30.
That's right.
Yeah, gathered out there. And it was just, you know, 30 years of this program is exciting in general. And then to have everyone together to kind of catch up and talk about what their favorite part of their class was. Just really cool to see.
And we're going to come back to that in a minute. Dylan Klein is here from Leadership Ames, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But tell us what else is going on.
Well, along the leadership lines in 2017, we're looking to really grow our, not just our Leadership Ames program, but our leadership programming in general. It's something that we feel is really important to our community, having people that are invested and involved in the community and giving them that inspiration and training to go out and keep making Ames the great place that it is. So our official launch details of this entire leadership program will be coming March 1st. But
so can you explain a little bit more what you mean about when you say leadership program?
Yeah, sure. So the leadership programs that we currently have are Leadership Ames. We do a Youth Leadership Ames program, and then various events throughout the year, maybe lunch and learns or breakfast events where we'll bring in a speaker and we'll have, you know, a group gather that's kind of one-on-one time with someone in the community or on a national level that maybe you want to pick their brain and find out, you know, what inspires them, what makes them excited to do what they do every day. Our 2017 event, annual event, was in January of this year. We actually had John Gordon, who is a best-selling author and speaker, come in and talk about the power of positive energy and how to use that, you know, either for yourself or in a team setting, but how positive energy really impacts you and can help your project, your team, anything that you're working on. We had 800 people there, members.
That's a big crowd.
Yeah, it was awesome to see. It's the largest event that the Chamber has ever done, I suppose, aside from Farmers Market, if you count that one beats it. But
where did this happen?
This was out at Cornerstone Church. it's, you know, to accommodate that many people, one of mm-hmm. the few places that we could do that. So
So you're planning to have more lectures like that in this year?
Yeah. We'd mm-hmm. like to kind of continue that momentum with that event and provide opportunities for members of the community, students in Ames or the surrounding area to come in and just be able to hear from, you know, national speakers. We also really want to focus on finding those people here in our own community that have amazing stories to share.
So this is kind of a emphasis on building vision for the community. Is that right? Is that
for
what I'm
sure.
hearing?
Yep. I think you're exactly correct in that. Mm-hmm. So we'll have a series of probably 4 or 5 events, panels either in the morning, over lunch, you know, trying to accommodate everyone's different schedules.
And are these open to the public?
We do want to invite everyone to come. Since they are chamber events, you know, the members of the chamber have already paid a price that helps us be able to put on these programs. So there may be pricing differences for a ticket where a member would mm-hmm. be less than the community, but we do want to open it up to everyone.
Where would one find a schedule for these lectures?
Well, once we release our schedule on March 1st, all of that information will be posted on the chamber website, which is mm-hmm. www.ameschamber.com. And so that would be a great place to start. We're also going to try and get the information out in other ways. So.
Okay. And we're speaking with Lauren Franson from the Ames Chamber of Commerce, which has been focusing on building vision for the yep. community. Anything else you want to talk about in regards to plans for 2017?
On the Ames economic development side of things, we have more, you know, projects, buildings, activities going on in Ames, and John Hall, who is our director of marketing and such for the AEDC, will, I think, next month plan on talking about some of the big projects going on for them,
okay.
What they're focused on in 2017. But it's going to be another great year. We're excited for events that we have, projects going on, and our Leadership Ames class.
Yes, the Leadership Ames class, we do have news on that front. The Leadership Ames class is a group that's put together every year by the Chamber of Commerce, and this year they are partnering with KHOI. And Dylan Klein is here with us from the class of 2017, Leadership Ames.
That's right, class number 30.
Class number 30.
Which happens to be the best class ever.
Yeah. So Dylan, tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so as part of the Leadership Ames program, the team or the group is split into teams, and then those teams are to put on a project, and we get to choose what our project is, and our group selected to work with KHOI. We got introduced with KHOI through the session, the Leadership Ames session on nonprofits, and just kind of got excited about what was going on here and decided to partner with KHOI to establish a radio program about business.
And what's the program called?
It's called Business Connect.
Business Connect.
Business Connect.
Explain that title.
Business Connect. So we like the idea of telling stories about businesses, not just in Ames, but in the greater area as well. And we like the idea of connect, seeing how all of the pieces fit together and build a story. You know, there's the small business, there's the industrial aspect, there's nonprofit organizations, there's starting a small business, and all of the people and places and organizations that go into establishing those things. We want to kind of tell that story.
Okay, so new radio show, Business Connect. You heard it first here on Local Talk.
That's right.
And when is the show going to be happening?
Well, we've been putting together the first show, and we're shooting for this Friday at 1 o'clock to have our inaugural episode.
The debut.
The debut. There you go. Debut episode. I can say that word easily.
So this is going to be striving to be a show that is maybe start out once or twice a month. And then we'll see how, you know, whether it becomes a weekly show or what happens.
That's right.
Right.
I think the goal is 2 times a month.
Uh-huh.
And to kind of get it established and then see what happens from there.
Uh-huh. Just to explain now, Leadership Ames is a group of a class in a way that happens for a year?
It happens, right. I don't know, maybe 9 months, something like uh-huh. that.
Yep. September through May, I believe. Is,
right.
Yeah, and they have a graduation ceremony in May. And
and this class is made up of people from businesses and organizations that are part of the Chamber of Commerce they send people to apply to be part of this. And if you're accepted in the program, you go through a very diverse training program, kind of learning about lots of aspects of the community. And that's how you ended up learning about KHOI, coming here and getting to know us. And we all decided to work together to make this show called Business Connect.
That's right.
And so, Dylan, you are one of how many people working on the show?
There are five from Leadership Aims, and then KHOI has partnered with us with another three or four folks from the organization, from board members, and the station manager, Ursula, who you're hearing from now. And it's definitely a collaborative process. The folks that are from Leadership Aims that are a part of the program, none of us have broadcast backgrounds, and so we feel a little bit like fish out of water. You know, it's not our training to do interviews and put on a radio program and how to put together a story. And so the staff at KHOI have been instrumental in putting that together for us, and in a way teaching us how to tell a story.
And what do you do professionally?
Professionally, I am a project manager for Integrity Construction, and I work in our residential home building side of our business. We also have a commercial side of our business, and then home remodel.
So you know how to build things.
That's right. Stories, I'm learning how to build a story.
So how is it going? How are you guys doing?
As far as Integrity Construction?
Integrity Construction, I have no concerns about.
That's right. We're doing well, yeah.
How's the radio show going?
The radio show is going well. Yeah, it's a lot of effort for think about a 30-minute program, but you don't. I hadn't realized how much effort goes into each one of those minutes on that program, and so it, especially being a novice and not really and just kind of finding our way through the program, it has taken a lot of hours and group meetings and emails and organizing interviews and sitting down and talking with people and then sorting through that information that you have. So it's yeah.
So what have you done yourself? What have you had to do?
Well, it's a lot of group meetings to kind of establish a vision for the show, kind of getting ideas for a trajectory for the next six shows. But also I designed the logo for our show, which was kind of fun. You can probably see that on the KHOI,
it's a good logo.
KHOI website. Sat down with an interview with Brian Dieter with Mary Greeley Medical Center, who's a platinum sponsor of Leadership Aims, to get his perspective on why Leadership Aims is important and why leadership is important in general and the value of going. Mary Greeley Medical Center has sent, Brian estimated, between one and two dozen people through this program. And so it's obviously of great value in the medical center's mind. So just to
and
chat with him about that.
It's quite competitive to get into it, isn't it?
That's right. I'll let.
Yeah, it seems like every year it's a growing number of applicants, which is awesome. We want to offer it to as many people as possible, and that it has a reputation in the businesses around our community for being an important program and something that the participants get a lot out of is great too.
Mm-hmm. And on our end, we're excited that this group has decided to work with us because we feel like it's an excellent way for us to connect with business in this community and get a voice for what's happening in the business world, you know, through the eyes of people who are really personally involved. So we're really excited about the show, and we're impressed at how professionally and energetically and creatively everybody in your group has approached this project. Is there anything that sticks out in your mind as in terms of what you've learned from doing this so far? I know you're just at the beginning.
Well, I feel like I've learned a lot. I think what I shared earlier, just the amount of effort it takes to put together a program like this that folks want to listen to. I listen to NPR a lot and just kind of take for granted that the content is interesting and, you know, broad range of topics and things like that, but never had really thought about the effort that goes into putting that together. And also the storytelling aspect of what it takes to build a program that is going to be interesting and people will want to listen to. Mm-hmm. And I've learned that as well.
Okay.
I continue to learn. Yeah. Every time I'm working on my portion of the program, I feel like I'm just continually learning things and having new perspectives.
Well, very interesting. Okay. So Business Connect, new show on KHOI starting this Friday at 1 about the business community and some of the ideas and people that make up that community and the stories that it holds, right?
That's right.
Okay, Dylan, any last words before we wrap it up?
No, I thank you for giving us the opportunity to kind of promote the show a little bit. And thanks for having me in the studio.
Well, it's very impressive how much time. We know that you're all very busy people. And the fact that you've put this much energy and devoted so much time is very impressive. So I'm excited to hear what happens on Friday.
Yeah, we'll see. Tune in at 1 o'clock.
Tune in at 1 o'clock here at KHOI. And you've been listening to KHOI. This is Local Talk. We've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Kay Patak. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard a little bit of music from Ralph Towner today during the show. You can also listen to this show and all of your past Local Talk shows online at khoifm.org. And you'll hear today's show there pretty soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron. Again, that's khoifm.org.
KHOI streams live online at khoifm.org, where you can also find an archive of today's shows. Please remember that you, as listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting the award-winning National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu. Center.iastate.edu.
Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting The Importance of Being Earnest, a trivial comedy for serious people, a satire by Oscar Wilde, February 24th through March 5th at Fisher Theater in Ames. Tickets and more information can be found at theater.iastate.edu.